Okay. Good evening. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive of the RSA, and I'd like to welcome you to the RSA this evening. I'm the boring speaker before all the interesting speakers. I have to start with a few housekeeping points. Turn off your mobile phone. You've all done it already. Isn't that fantastic? If the fire alarm sounds, please leave the great room by either of the signposted fire escapes. We muster on the opposite side of John Adams Street. At the end of the event, if you could complete your feedback questionnaire and hand it back to a member of RSA staff or reception, we'd be very grateful to you. Like most RSA events, this session is being broadcast live on our website. An edited audio file and a transcript will be available on our website in a few days' time. This evening's lecture has been organised by the RSA with the Royal Institution and in association with Penguin Books. We have an expert panel to discuss the trouble with physics, the rise of string theory, the fall of a science, and what comes next. Professor Lee Smolin's book is published today by Penguin UK. It'll be on sale after the lecture, and Professor Smolin has kindly agreed to sign copies. Our chair for this evening, who will introduce Lee and other speakers more fully, is Professor Chris Eystrom, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the Blackett Laboratory Imperial College. So will you please join me in welcoming Chris, Lee, and our distinguished panel. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. The organisers have asked me to just give a little bit of the sort of scientific background to the debate this evening. But first, so you know who's who, let me introduce briefly the people on the platform. Nearest to me in the red corner is Lee Smolin, who will be presenting the case. And then next to him on the right is Mike Duff, who will be in the blue corner, who's defending the case. And right at the very end will be Nancy Cartwright, who's a philosopher of science and sociology. So that's how we're going to do things. I've been asked to tell you also that this particular meeting runs on a bit later than usual, so it finishes at 7:45. So don't get worried if you think we're overrunning, because we may be, but that's not going to be the problem. Okay. So let me start by saying that 40 years ago, I hate to say it, but it's true, 40 years ago I was a PhD student at Imperial College doing theoretical physics. And in those days, the whole structure of the subject was very different from what it does today. There basically were two different types of theoretical physics people did, two groups. The biggest group by far was people doing particle physics, to which all three of us belonged, actually. And then there's a much smaller group of people who were doing general relativity, Einstein's theory of curved space and time. Now, these are two quite different subjects. And by and large, the people who worked in these fields had quite different educations. They didn't talk to each other very much. And that's fine, because everybody did what they had to do. They got funded for it, and that's fine. But then a very small number of people started to ask, how could these two things be brought together? When I was a student, I got very interested in this, but it was a long time ago. And the very few people then did this subject. And in fact, it was totally and completely unjustified, because there's no data whatsoever. It was impossible either to falsify or verify the theory or do anything. There was no justification for it whatsoever, except it was a fascinating problem. And that's why people began to work on it. Now, because of this division, the training even theoretical physicists had in those days, very rapidly the subject split into two schools. There was the school who came from the particle physics background, like we did, who basically worked in four dimensions. That's called the covariant formalism. And then the relativists preferred to work in three dimensions, and that's called the canonical formalism. Now, you might think, well, four, three dimensions, I mean, what's the difference? But in fact, the bifurcation was enormous between these schools, and there used to be terrible arguments. When I was very young and impressionable academic in 1970, our first time ever we had a conference where I was then working on quantum gravity, and there were relativists there and there were particle physicists there. And at one point, one of the four-dimensional people, who was a very distinguished man, went up to a three-dimensional person like this. So I hope that doesn't happen this evening. But... But like I said beforehand, don't be too bland either, because people... So these two schools developed and evolved over the years. And the four-dimensional people became 10 dimensional people, 11 dimensional people, and then 10 dimensional people again. And that's now the school of superstring, M theory, the subject really we're talking about this evening. That was a big major development and is the major part of theoretical physics in this subject. The other half, the canonical people, evolved into what's now become called loop quantum gravity. Lee was one of the founders of that subject, and Mike has made very major contributions to string theory. So you have the two sort of different people here. Now, in the course of my career, which does go back a long way, I have to admit now, I often used to wonder what we were doing when we were doing quantum gravity, because ordinary physics, you have like three things, really. At least I was thinking this way. You've got the data from the real world, you've got the mathematics, and you have the philosophy. And these three things, they kind of lock together. If one of them is missing, the whole thing becomes a bit haywire. And this is what happened, because we had all the mathematics and the concepts, but no data. Now, under those circumstances, you might think, well, what do scientists actually do? And the answer is they simply give vent to their philosophical and scientific prejudices. It's more or less true. Now, as I got older, I get more senior, because I began to sit on selection panels for things. And the interesting question arises, how do you judge whether the piece of work in quantum gravity is good or bad? Because if there's no data, if you can't falsify it, if there's no real justification for doing it, except it's a fascinating problem, why is it good, why is it bad? And I decided that really it's like a composer who writes a piece of music. It's a nice tune. Everybody likes it. They all sing the same tune for a while, and you become well known. And to some extent, I think Lee will actually pick up this point. This is just how I saw what was happening in quantum gravity studies. Now, for people like Mike or Lee and I, who are well established in our careers, it doesn't matter. But for young people, actually, this can be a big problem, because if one particular tune becomes so popular, everybody sings nothing but that, the people who sing the discord, as it were, may eventually be run out of funding, which I think is one aspect of what Lee's going to say. And this is a real problem, in my opinion. It's a problem of any science if this happens. Now, this evening's debate is not actually about physics. I mean, I don't imagine we're going to have an in-depth discussion of string theory. It's really about the sociology of science and how it works. So let me start off then by introducing Lee Smoley. Each speaker will speak for exactly 20 minutes, and I shall cut them off, shake them, something like this. So Lee Smoley will speak first to the title of his book, which is The Trouble with Physics. Lee.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. And I want to also thank very much Michael Duff for doing this, which is a very generous and courageous thing to do. And I'm very... So to come in, not everybody said yes to this invitation. I'm very happy and honored that he did. And I'm very honored that Nancy Cartwright, who is a very eminent and influential philosopher, agreed to do this. And I hope we live up to the expectations. As Chris said, this is not about physics, but it is about physics both. And that's part of the lesson. I want to start off in saying this book has been read. It came out first in the United States, and it's been misread and not read. And it's been characterized, for example, as being, quote, against string theory, almost always by people who, when they were asked, turned out not to have read it. The book is not against string theory. It's not for or against any particular development. What is the book really about? The key to the book, for me, is a quotation from a Brazilian-American philosopher, Roberto Mangibera Unger, who starts his latest book, and I'm just going to quote it and then focus in from it, by saying, in what kind of world and for what kind of thought is time real, history open, and novelty possible? In what kind of world and for what kind of thought does it make sense for a human being to look for trouble rather than to try to stay out of trouble? So that's what the book is about. And let me start. There are really three key points or three key steps. Okay. First, the concern is how science works. And there is a view of what science is and how science works, which I present. And the key question that I'm interested in is the role of disagreement and controversy and how it is that in any important step forward in science, there is a period of disagreement, controversy, debate, sometimes friendly, sometimes not friendly. But then what, and that, of course, that's like every domain of human life and endeavor. But in science, there's something unusual, which is there is some process which, by which we go from that state of debate and controversy to a state of consensus. And how does that happen? Okay. And I'm interested in that. I'm not a professional philosopher or sociologist, but that was the concern that I started with, and that really is what the book is about. The view that I develop is that we face the unknown in science. There are, for any interesting question, as Chris explained, there in the questions of interest to theoretical physicists now, but it's always been the case, there are divergent points of view. Different experts, different well-trained people think different parts of the question are more important. They ask a question different ways. They're influenced by different philosophical traditions and ideas, and there are divergent approaches. And that's healthy. That's the main message of the book. In fact, that's why I asked to make these presentations in England of the book. I asked to have them in the form of discussion and debate, because that's the point of the book, is that discussion and disagreement among experts is essential, because nobody knows what is the right thing. Okay. However, what's different about science is that when you become a scientist, you sign on to an ethic, and an ethic that, this is my view now, in which you acknowledge that the community and not yourself is the ultimate judge of what's correct. And that the community, consisting of individuals who are sure of themselves and confident, will still come to agree when they're forced to it, kicking and screaming by the evidence. And what you agree to by becoming a scientist is to be governed by rational argument from the evidence. You agree to be open to changing your mind. And from time to time, consensus does form around a new idea, a new theory, when the evidence and rational argument from the evidence forces us to that. And almost always that has to do with experiment. And the view of science, this view of science requires that in the absence of being forced to consensus, we should encourage the widest possible among, and I'm not talking about amateurs and quacks and so forth who really don't play a role, I'm talking about in the scientific community of well-trained, credentialed people, we should do whatever we can to encourage intellectual freedom, independence, and the widest range. Even if I think, if I'm sure that my research program is right, it helps my research program to have very good people who have contrary views and research programs. Okay. And we should only come to consensus when we're forced to it, but that happens often enough, because not only are theorists clever, but experimentalists are even cleverer. Okay. That's the first thesis. Now, in this light, what is our situation in fundamental physics? Well, Chris outlined it. Let me very quickly say, because part of this book is an examination into our present strange situation in fundamental physics. So this will be very telegraphic. First, we face severe unsolved problems, completing the unification, the revolution that Einstein started at the beginning of the 20th century. Some of the questions are to make sense of quantum mechanics, to bring together gravity and relativity in quantum mechanics, which is the problem of quantum gravity. There's a problem of explaining the structure of the laws that we have already, that we understand. For example, there's a standard model of particle physics. And there are annoying, incomprehensible so far, clues from experiment like the dark matter and the dark energy. Okay. Now, in response to these problems, all of which had been there since before I was an undergraduate student, with the exception of the dark energy, there are diverse research programs and ideas being investigated, and that's good. And string theory is one of them, okay, but only one of them. Okay. One thing that probably will come up, which is about science, I mean, we don't have time to go into the different research programs probably and their relative successes and failures. It can be said of string theory and it can be said of other research programs that it partly has succeeded. There have been great achievements. There have been great discoveries mathematically. There has been great achievements as, you know, that I admire very much and we all admire in the development of string theory, of spin foam models, of topos theory, of loop quantum gravity, of dynamical triangulations, of causal set theory and technicolor, et cetera. The list goes on. But none has fully succeeded to do two things that any theory must do. One of them is make precise, falsifiable predictions. And this is the legacy of Karl Popper from London, falsifiability, by which the theory confronts experiment and confronts it directly. That is, if the prediction that's on the table is not obtained in the experiment, that theory must be wrong. And it's very interesting why that hasn't happened. And the second is also none has a completely coherent and convincing formulation starting from a principle and then expressing itself in elegant mathematics the way that general relativity has. Broadly speaking, some approaches take developments from particle physics more seriously as the starting point and use the ways of thinking and methods, and string theory is one of them, and others take the great lesson of general relativity as the starting point. To my mind, and this will come up, the great lesson of general relativity is an idea we call background independence. That is, there is, first of all, the geometry of space, as was long thought, is not fixed, is not absolute, is not eternal. It's just something that evolves along with everything else. There's nothing in the formulation of the laws of physics that should be fixed and absolute and not be part of a network of relations which is dynamical. This view that I'm expounding, we learn from general relativity and we call it background independence. Philosophers call it relationalism. The opposing tradition is called background dependence, and it's that you set off what is the geometry in which one wants to study things moving, what is the history of the universe in which one then wants to study things against that background. And for better or worse, so far string theory is formulated that way, although I have spent many years and other people have spent many years trying to transfer string theory to the first kind of theory. But there's this disjunction between background independence and background dependence, and that's related to the disjunction that Chris talked about between three dimensions and four dimensions. Okay. Now, so far, there is no direct contact with experiment for any of these developments. Some of these developments do make general expectations, not firm predictions of the kind I talked about, but general expectations for upcoming experiments. There is the Large Hadron Collider coming online in Geneva, and if you believe that string theory is a deep insight into nature, then there's a package deal that comes along with that, which includes a constraint on the theory called supersymmetry and includes a belief in six or seven extra dimensions. And if you're very optimistic, you believe that evidence for that, for either one or both of those things, will be seen at the Large Hadron Collider, and it may be. But since string theory nor any of the other programs makes a specific prediction for exactly where and how these features will be realized, the outcome will be crucial for the development of science, but it will not tell us whether string theory is true or not, whether spin foam models are true or not, etc. There are other experiments also coming online which really probe whether the principles of the special theory of relativity are true or need modification when quantum mechanics and gravity meet. And these are also very important experiments. They've been going on, actually, for billions of years. And these are experiments where light may be propagating for billions of years and very small effects from quantum geometry, quantum gravity, may be accumulating in the passages and interactions of these particles, which then can be teased out when they're detected by satellites in orbit on Earth or by detectors on Earth. And there are several very important experiments that test crucial principles there. But we will learn something important from those experiments. but none of the theories we have in front of us will be tested up or down from them. Okay. So that was my second point. That's a rough sketch of the situation. Okay. The rest is wisdom, good judgment, things that eminent people like Chris have and I don't have, but I'm going to try. Okay. And in some sense, the book is an attempt to realize the ambition of that quotation from Roberto Unger that I read. Okay, that's hovering there always in the background. I hope it stays there. About the desire for a world that's open, in which time is real and progress is real. Because this is not postmodernism. This is post-postmodernism. But what's the good advice? So some of it is obvious. If after many years of exploration, an idea has been very deeply explored by hundreds of very good people, and this applies not just to string theory, but also some of the other research programs I've worked on, okay, and it has failed in the two aspects that I've said, to either have a complete coherent formulation or to make up and down predictions, we haven't wasted our time, and let nobody say that we've wasted our time or the work has not been brilliant or interesting or compelling. But most likely, it's not the complete truth. Maybe even it's completely off track. So therefore, the most important thing, okay, and to mirror again some things Chris says, okay, is to organize science in the academy in such a way that the audacity and the independence and the courage of a young person who will come, okay, and propose the right direction and the right idea, whether it grows out of string theory or grows out of loop quantum gravity or does not, there will be, I'm confident, some person, maybe one of us older people, but if history is a guide, more likely somebody younger, who will propose what turns out to be the right route. And the most important thing is to work in a field which is open to that and which invites that. That's the key thing. Everything else that is in way of advice is to enable that. For example, and one way to say that, there's a metaphor that I heard about from an economist, Eric Weinberg, after I wrote the book, or it would be in the book, but I'll close with this. And this is we may talk about a problem in string theory and other theories called the landscape, and this is the way he proposes to think of this. Imagine that all the different ideas, good ideas that people could have, are hills in a complicated mountainous landscape. Okay. And the closer an idea is to working, the higher the hill. Okay. What we're seeking is maybe not the summit, maybe there isn't a summit, but we're seeking the best hill, the highest mountain that we can get to. And I don't need to be committed to whether there's an absolute best theory or final theory. That's irrelevant. But there are higher and lower summits. So, and the whole scene is shrouded in fog, so we can't look and see how where we are compares to other places on the landscape. So then there are different kinds of scientists. Most of us, and mostly I include myself in this, are hill climbers. That is, you put down, we're well trained, we're clever, we got advanced because we were clever kids. You put us down a slope, we figure out which way is up, and we go there. Okay. And that's what most of professional science is. And that's what most of it should be, because most of professional science is not trying to solve these deep foundational issues such as the nature of space and time or quantum theory. Okay. Unaccountably, there are a few who go down when the rest of us go up. And these, Eric Weinberg calls valley crossers. They will go down on their own to get away from everybody else or because they have a mirage in their mind. Many of them get lost, but what they do for science is they find the other hills. And they find new ways up. Okay. Of course, this is a metaphor that comes also from evolutionary biology, where the metaphor of the landscape in physics comes originally. So the message is, I mean, most of us are hill climbers. I'm a hill climber. Sometimes I jump around and help climb one hill, and then I jump around to another hill. But I'm basically a hill climber. The hills that I climb were not discovered by me. They were discovered by people with the audacity and the verve and the swagger to find new hills. And the message is, if we want, you know, as wonderful as the work on loop quantum gravity has been, as wonderful and as admirable as the work on string theory and other approaches has been, what we seem to have discovered is a bunch of hills. And what we have is a bunch of communities of people camped out on the top of the hills saying, my hill is better than your hill, reasons. And what we need in that situation is to open up science and make sure, it's not going to be many people, but make sure there's room for those rare people who go down, cross the valleys, and find the right hill. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Lee. That's perfect timing, too. Our next speaker is Mike Duff from Imperial College, a colleague of mine for many years. He's the Abdus Salam Professor there of Theoretical Physics. As I said earlier, he's made a number of contributions to the field of string theory. Now, I asked him for his title just beforehand. We were meeting, and his title of his talk is What Trouble?
The trouble with physics, ladies and gentlemen, is that there is not one Lee Smolin, but two. On the one hand, there is the reasonable Lee Smolin, who has just spoken to you, and with whom I hope to share a drink later this evening. Who can dispute that the ultimate goal of a scientific theory is to make experimentally testable predictions? Who will challenge the need to keep an open mind and listen to unorthodox views? Who can disagree with the assertion that our current understanding is only partial and that the ultimate truth is yet to be uncovered? What he has said is so uncontroversial that there's really very little to object to. So were I to respond only to the reasonable Lee Smolin, there's a danger that this debate would degenerate into a bland exchange of truisms. Unfortunately for physics, but fortunate perhaps for those of you who've come along expecting a vigorous debate this evening, there is the Lee Smolin who wrote the book The Trouble with Physics, which is, after all, the reason why we're all here this evening. And this Lee Smolin is far from reasonable. He has some very unpleasant and, more importantly, very inaccurate things to say about both string theory as a science and about string theorists as scientists. Let's start with the book cover, and I quote, "As a scientific theory, string theory has been a colossal failure and is dragging down the rest of physics." And that's just for starters. In fact, many of my string theory colleagues found the book so offensive, believing it to be a gross perversion of the truth, that they urged me to dissociate myself from it and refusing to take part in this debate. As Lee acknowledged, not everyone wanted to take part. And part of it is because they view Lee and Peter Woit, the author of a similar book, Attacking String Theory, as both making a living off the backs of those who are doing all the hard work. I think it was Yeats who said, "There never was a dog that praised its fleas." But in my opinion, eventually there comes a time when the dog has to scratch. And that's why I've agreed to speak this evening. Moreover, these distortions have by now received quite a wide publicity. For example, in last week's Mail on Sunday, someone called Harry Ritchie reviewed The Trouble with Physics and repeated without qualification some of the more outrageous claims in the book. And I quote, "String theory has made no discernible progress after 20 years. Just a huge amount of unprovable conjecture. Of the hundreds," let me repeat this carefully, "of the hundreds of research appointments in American universities since 1990, only three have gone to non-stringies." Now, I don't mind that journalists like Harry Ritchie are ignorant about string theory. Most people are. What's irksome, however, is their propensity to pontificate about it without bothering to check the facts. The no progress claim is simply silly, and I'll be describing some progress in just a few minutes. The unprovable conjecture claim is equally misleading. Conjecture and refutation is a time-honored way to proceed in scientific research, and string theory is no different. Sometimes our conjectures are proved, sometimes disproved. Sometimes no proof is forthcoming, but such a vast amount of circumstantial evidence is accumulated that we adopt the conjecture as a working hypothesis until such time as a proof comes along. And by the way, how does Harry Ritchie know that the conjectures so far unproved are unprovable? Perhaps he'd care to lend me his crystal ball. Finally, a couple of phone calls would easily have refuted the only three appointments claim. I spent the years 1999 to 2005 at the University of Michigan, and the last two permanent faculty appointments in theoretical physics were both to non-string theorists. Multiply that by the dozens of similar departments in the US, and you begin to see what a flagrant misrepresentation the three out of hundreds really is. I might add that it's equally untrue in the UK. At my own department at Imperial College, for example, 7 out of the last 10 faculty appointments since 1990 were to non-string theorists. Of course, the Mail on Sunday has never been a paper to allow facts to get in the way of good story. Where I do agree with Harry Ritchie, and indeed with every other reviewer of the book, is that it is a venomous attack on string theory, notwithstanding the claims of the reasonable Lee Smolin that it isn't. Now, don't get me wrong. If Lee had confined his sociological criticisms to saying that some theorists are arrogant, exclusive, unwilling to listen to orthodox views, then that's fair game. In fact, there's probably some truth in that. In fact, I'm reminded of the one about the philandering string theorist, who, when confronted by his wife, said, "But darling, I can explain everything." So that's fair enough, but when Lee conflates sociology with science and accuses the string theorists of being bad scientists, that's fighting talk. Let me say a little bit about string theory and its successor, M-theory. Theoretical physicists like to ask the big questions. How did the universe begin? What are its fundamental constituents? What are the laws of nature that govern those constituents? And the situation we faced at the end of the last century, notwithstanding the great success of the standard model of particle physics and the standard cosmological model in providing partial answers to these questions, was that the two main pillars of 20th century physics, quantum mechanics and Einstein's general theory of relativity, were mutually incompatible. Quantum theory deals with the very small, atoms, subatomic particles, and the forces between them. General relativity deals with the very large, stars, galaxies, and gravity, the driving force of the cosmos as a whole. And the dilemma we faced was that on the microscopic scale, Einstein's theory failed to comply with the quantum rules that govern the behavior of the elementary particles, while on the macroscopic scale, black holes are threatening the very foundations of quantum mechanics. So something big has to give, and this augurs perhaps a new scientific revolution. But no one said it was going to be easy. Constructing an all-embracing theory that unifies gravity and quantum mechanics and goes on to describe all physical phenomena is probably the most ambitious challenge in the history of science. Finding ways in which such a theory could be tested empirically will be equally difficult, given the fact that the gravitational force is 40 orders of magnitude weaker than the other forces. Nevertheless, many physicists believe that this revolution is already underway with the theory of superstrings. As their name suggests, they are one-dimensional string-like objects, which just like violin strings can vibrate. And each mode of vibration, each note, if you like, represents a different elementary particle. So that note would be a quark, that note would be a Higgs boson, this note a graviton, and so on. Now, one strange feature of superstrings is that they live in a universe with 9 space and 1 time dimensions. Since the world around us appears to have only 3 space dimensions, the extra six must somehow be curled up to an unobservably small size, or else rendered invisible in some other way, if the theory is to be at all realistic. Fortunately, the equations of string theory admit solutions where that actually happens. And the main reason why theorists are so excited about string theory is that it seems at long last to provide the long-dreamed-of consistent quantum theory of gravity, and holds promise of incorporating and extending the standard models of particle physics and cosmology. Now, string theorists are the first to admit that the theory is by no means complete, but is constantly undergoing improvement in the light of new discoveries. For example, one of the problems with the form of the theory developed in the 1980s was that there was not one superstring theory, but five. Five mathematically consistent superstrings. Now, if one's looking for a unique theory of everything, five theories of everything seems like an embarrassment of riches. In 1995, the theory underwent a revolution when it was realized that these five strings were not different after all, but rather just five corners of a deeper and more profound theory that we now call M-theory. M-theory involves membrane-like objects which live not in 10 but 11 space-time dimensions. For the purposes of tonight's debate, I'll often use the word string theory, but they're meant to incorporate M-theory as well. String and M-theory continue to make remarkable theoretical progress. For example, by providing the first microscopic derivation of the black hole entropy formula first proposed by Stephen Hawking in the mid-70s. And solving long outstanding theoretical problems such as these gives us an indication that we're on the right track. But as so often happens in science, M-theory presented new problems of its own, not least of which is that its equations admit even more solutions than string theory does. And at the moment, we have no idea which one, if any, nature should pick to describe our universe. Theorists are divided on this issue. Some think that when we understand the theory better, we will understand why one unique universe is singled out, thus answering in the negative Einstein's question, did God have any choice in creating the universe? Others think that there are indeed many, possibly infinitely many different universes, and we just happen to be living in one of them. The problem of how to choose one universe out of a large, possibly infinite number of mathematically possible universes is sometimes called the landscape problem. And lacking an answer to this problem, the theory is as yet unable to give a definitive smoking gun experimental prediction that would render the theory falsifiable. Of course, there are some generic features of string theory, like supersymmetric particles, extra dimensions, microscopic black holes, cosmic strings. And if we're lucky, some of these may be confirmed at the Large Hadron Collider, due to be switched on in Geneva later this year, or perhaps in the next generation of astrophysical observations. But like Lee, I think, one thing we agree on, I'm doubtful whether the kind of issues we're debating tonight will be resolved anytime soon. Now, critics like Lee and Peter Woit say that since you've been working on M-theory since 1995, it's time to give up. Others like myself say it's still early days. And there's an important point here that I'd like to stress. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, we all stopped working on string theory tomorrow. Started with a clean sheet of paper, sharpened our pencils, and say, what do we do now? The landscape problem would not have gone away. The problem of how to choose one physical universe out of a large, possibly infinite number of mathematically possible universes is a problem that any attempt to provide a final theory is going to have to confront. Why do we appear to live in just four space-time dimensions? Why is the number of fundamental forces four? Gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear force. Why are the elementary particles arranged in three families of quarks and leptons? These riddles are not unique to string theory, and at the moment, none of the alternative theories has any answer to them. So this is perhaps a good time to pause and ask about the relation between theory and experiment in physics. The image held by many people goes something like this. Some theoretical genius thinks up a bright idea in his or her armchair and shouts Eureka. The next day they write a paper summarizing the theory and suggesting ways of testing it in the laboratory. Shortly afterwards, an experimental colleague performs the experiment, confirms the theory, and the following October both go to Stockholm to collect their Nobel Prizes. Alas, the reality is usually completely different. Theories rarely spring fully formed from the minds of their discoverers. They usually begin with the germ of an idea that needs to be nurtured and nourished and then gradually improved upon by others. And I'd like to consider a couple of examples. Let's take black holes. The existence of black holes, objects so dense that not even light can escape, is now well supported by astronomical observation, particularly from X-ray emission from binary stars. But the theory of black holes goes back to John Mitchell in 1784 and Pierre Laplace in 1786. They reasoned that there was a critical radius below which a massive body would have an escape velocity that exceeds the velocity of light, and that that body would therefore be invisible. And this idea was basically correct. But it did not reach theoretical maturity until the arrival of Einstein's general relativity in 1916 and the discovery of what we now call the Schwarzschild black hole solution. And this solution was still not taken seriously, even by Einstein. Some years pass, and then in 1939, Oppenheimer of Manhattan fame and Schneider showed that after burning up their nuclear fuel, sufficiently massive stars would undergo gravitational collapse and form black holes. But even this work was largely ignored until the observational evidence for black holes started to accumulate in the 1970s. So I find myself in disagreement with Lee when he says in his book, and I quote, "When you look back at the history of physics, one thing sticks out. When the right theory is finally proposed, it triumphs quickly." A second example would be quantum entanglement. One of the strangest and most fascinating physical phenomena is quantum entanglement. The basic problem was set forth in 1935 by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, who pointed out that there was a conflict between quantum theory and local reality, or what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. But it wasn't until 1964 that CERN theorist John Bell came up with an empirically falsifiable prediction. And it was not until 1982 that experimentalist Alan Aspey was able to conduct Bell's suggested experiment. He verified empirically, by the way, that quantum mechanics is right, Einstein was wrong, and local realism has to go out of the window. So once again, I find myself in disagreement with Lee when he says in his book, "Before the 1970s, theory and experiment had developed hand in hand. New ideas were tested within a few years, 10 at most." There are lots of other examples in the history of physics that I'll cut short, but there are two morals, I think, to be drawn from these examples. The first, more obvious one, is that we frequently have to wait for technology to catch up with the theory. Many theoretical predictions were not confirmed until the arrival of more sophisticated hardware, more powerful telescopes, or particle accelerators. The second moral, harder perhaps to grasp, but one of vital importance for this evening's debate, is that it frequently takes a long time for an original theoretical idea to mature to the stage where it can be cast into a smoking gun prediction that be contested experimentally. Many confused critics of string theory have declared that unless you're making falsifiable predictions, you are not doing science. Well, were Mitchell, Laplace, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, Oppenheimer, Schneider not therefore doing science? Well, of course they were. Their only problem is that they were ahead of their time. So let me finally then return to the book and why so many string theorists are upset about it. In the chapter Seers versus Craftspeople, Lee Smolin divides scientists into two camps. There are the craftspeople who, though competent at doing tedious calculations, are merely unimaginative drones doing what others have told them to do. And then there are the seers, who have all the real vision and creative genius. Needless to say, Lee consigns the entire string community to the dustbin of craftspeople. Page 287, why are string theorists not seers? Page 290, I can think of no mainstream string theorist who has proposed an original idea about the foundations of quantum theory or the nature of time. Page 287, it does not take much foresight or courage to think about strings. So when Nobel laureates Murray Gell-Mann, Abdus Salam, Steven Weinberg, David Gross all gave up what they were doing in order to study string theory, when Fields medalists Michael Atiyah and Edward Witten established deep connections between pure mathematics and string theory, and when Stephen Hawking devoted his latest book to M-theory, they were all, according to Lee Smolin, lacking foresight. Quote, so little fulfillment is exactly what you get when a lot of highly trained master craftspeople try to do the work of a seer. Who then are the seers? It's not Gell-Mann or Weinberg, Hawking. Well, Lee leaves us in no doubt. With a toe-curling display of self-aggrandizement, he announces, I think of myself as a seer. To make matters worse, at the end of his book, he devotes some time to condemning racism and sexism in higher education. And when this is all mixed up with attacks on string theory, the reader is left with the impression that practically all the ills of society are to be laid at the feet of string theory. How should one react to such a book? My own reaction is best summed up by an analogy with football. Let's suppose the manager of a football club, I don't know, Watford, were to write a book called The Trouble with Football, whose cover announces that another club, let's say Manchester United, are, as a football team, a colossal failure who are dragging down the rest of football. Why? Because although those United players may be scoring all the goals, winning all the trophies, garnering generous sponsorship, they're merely super fit craftspeople. All the players with real vision and creative genius, the seers, are playing for Watford. And the reason why most of the upcoming young talent wants to play for United rather than Watford is because they're deluded. How would such a book be received? Well, it might sell a few copies as a novelty item. Perhaps the Mail on Sunday would endorse it because they never like United anyway. But would it persuade discerning football fans? I think the answer is no, for the obvious reason. They would say that the only way to get more people to support your club and fewer to support your rivals, and the only way to persuade young talented players to join your team, is not by writing popular books, but by playing the game. And so it is in theoretical physics. The battle for the correct theory will not be won on the bookshelves of W.H. Smith, nor even in the debating chamber of the Royal Society for the Arts. The battle will be won on the pages of the scholarly scientific journals, or in their modern guise, on the electronic archives on the internet. The way to persuade your scientific colleagues that you have a good theory that is worthy of support is to publish your findings and present the most convincing case you can. If you don't like string theory, the answer is simple. Come up with a better one. The trouble with physics, ladies and gentlemen, is that Lee Smolin and Peter Woit, having lost their case in the court of science, are now trying desperately to win it in the court of popular opinion. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mike. I had actually worried before we started this meeting, it might be a little bit bland, everybody agreeing with each other, but it was a great mistake on my part. Now, a great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, who I think must have been smiling ironically to herself throughout these two talks. This is Professor Nancy Cartwright at London School of Economics. She works professionally in the philosophy and sociology of science, and she is surely better equipped than anybody to really comment on what's going on here. Nancy.
Oh, thank you. Chris asked for a title and insisted he would make one up if I didn't give it to him, and then he didn't like my title, so he failed to tell it to you, which is Physics is Conflict, and I'll explain that. The trouble with physics, Lee Smolin tells us, is the hegemony of string theory. Young theorists, he says, studying the most fundamental laws of nature cannot get a job unless they join the string theory movement. And should they have a job, they cannot get tenure. This was the unreasonable Lee Smolin, as he was described, right? Those who believe in alternative approaches are upbraided, even ridiculed, by those in the movement for being foolish, even for being stupid. Alternative work is not discussed nor understood within the string camp. And for the most part, most of the money, as well as the bright, ambitious young theorists, go to string theory. What's wrong with that? Well, two things, Smolin tells us. First, we've just had the discussion of string theory is not all that it is touted to be, Smolin claims. Many of its important putative successes are promises, not fact. Well, now, that's physics, and we've got a physics discussion going. I was asked to supply philosophical context. And the second problem with physics that Smolin talks about is one which is right up the alley of philosophy, something we work on all the time, and that's this, that even if string theory were all it's touted to be, this is no way to do physics. Now, philosophers with viewpoints like Smolin's argue that physics should be open, there should be a variety of approaches. These are the truisms, I think, but important truisms. It should be critical. The approaches should engage with each other's advantages and disadvantages, and it should be responsive. All sides should be heard, really heard. Okay? Now, why should physics be open, critical, and responsive? Maybe a truism, but we're in the game of asking for explanations. So why should it be open, critical, and responsive? The primary arguments among philosophers are modeled on J.S. Mill's On Liberty. We need to allow as much liberty as possible for people in designing their lives, because we don't know what is the best way to live. And that's in part because we don't know what are all the good alternatives to choose from. And the only way to get a full set of options is to encourage experiments in living, to encourage people to go out and do the hard, detailed labor it takes to figure out a genuine option for how to live. So too with physics. We don't know what the alternatives are. And any option, to be a genuine option in physics, must be detailed. It must be worked out. And that won't happen unless physicists are encouraged to work on alternatives. This argument, of course, rests on the assumption that we don't know what option is best. Now, according to Smolin, string theorists often dissent. They know string theory is best. Indeed, more than one of them, this I know is true, and more than once have prophesied that the end of physics is in view with string theory. Now, we don't need any more experiments in living. We know how to live. All we have to do is polish off a few details. Now, in ordinary life, we have a name for this kind of attitude, hubris, and most of us dislike it, indeed distrust it. Philosophers of science have a complicated name for a very simple argument as to why it is a bad idea in physics. The argument is called the pessimistic meta-induction. And it's this. All our best, most successful, most lovely basic theories in the past have been shown to be wrong. Any good method of reasoning from past to future tells us to bet that our current best, most successful, most lovely basic theory will be wrong as well. Now, I mention Mill's On Liberty as a central source for the structure of an argument in favor of an open physics, critical and responsive. Political theory provides a model for yet another kind of argument for the same conclusion. Mill pointed out that we don't know what the alternatives for a good or just life are. The second argument points out that even if we had all the alternatives somehow on the table in front of us, we have no good, grounded criteria for choice among them. Philosophers like Stuart Hampshire and Bernard Williams, philosophers who are sometimes labeled the Oxford pessimists, argue that there is no well-argued and well-evidenced theory of what constitutes justice or the good life that can and should command responsible universal consent. There is no universally acceptable substantive theory of justice or morality. Now, my title, Physics, is Conflict, is an echo of Hampshire's title, Justice is Conflict, in which he argues these points. And what Hampshire concludes is that at best, so we have no substantive, universally acceptable substantive theory of justice and morality, at best, what can be hoped for in its stead are reasonable procedures for managing conflict, which may include procedures for how to choose when choice is necessary, which is often not the case, and how to live together when it is not. Okay. Philosophers of science have paralleled the Oxford pessimists, for the most part, unwittingly. So we have these two bits of philosophy marching along, making sort of analogic, very much structurally similar arguments without sort of recognizing it. But philosophers of science have paralleled these views of the Oxford pessimists in moral and political theory in arguing that there is no substantive theory of what constitutes the best theory that can and should command universal responsible assent. At best, what we can hope for are reasonable procedures for managing disagreement, procedures that tell us how to choose when choice is necessary, as, for instance, in constructing lasers for eye surgery, where we do well to choose quantum mechanics and not rely just on Newton's and Maxwell's theories. So we want procedures that help us, that tell us how to choose when choice is necessary, but equally importantly, how to live together when you don't actually have to force a choice. Okay? And that includes procedures for how to nurture productive dissent and how to allocate scarce resources among competing points of view. Consider the disagreement between Smolin and the string theorists about the substantive theory of theory choice, or at least as Smolin pictures it. Smolin demands that acceptable theories produce new physical insights, not mathematical, but physical insights, and new successful empirical predictions, old venerable demands. Many string theorists, on his view, want to jettison these demands at this point in physics, denying that they are decisive universal criteria for theory choice. Mathematical insight matters, so they say, as does consistency. Matters a lot. And so does consistency with other theories and with certain intricate mathematical structures already in place. Now, philosophers of science call features like these, and there's a long list we usually come up with, empirical adequacy, surprising successful prediction, physical insight, consistency, simplicity, mathematical insight, etc., etc. We call these features epistemic virtues. The virtue part is suggestive. Like virtues of character, we cannot be assured that they will all come together in one package, so that you'll have all the good virtues with one theory and none with the other. And where they don't, we have no assurance that there is a universally correct ranking among them. Well, one virtue more important than the other in all cases, nor a universally correct procedure for weighing up various bundles. Further, even had we a rule for how to weigh the virtues against one another, these virtues are all far too vague to be of serious help. And if you really want to decide whether go to graduate school to pursue a certain kind of string theory or go study with Lee, holding up this list of empirical virtues and then saying, well, let's see which of these two theories does better, it's going to be absolutely useless to you because the terms in the list are so abstract and so vague. So you could try to improve by introducing context-specific virtues, as Smolin himself does, when he, at the beginning of his book, he's got five problems that he thinks any good fundamental theory now should be solving. So that's a context-specific set of criteria for theory choice. How well are you doing on these very, very much more concrete things? Those include, as we heard, they have virtues such as the unification of forces and particles, explaining dark matter, and cleaning up the foundations of quantum mechanics. Now, these two, though, are too vague to bite, as witnessed by the different assessments by small and versus string theorists on the achievements and promise of string theory itself on the five problems. Okay. So the lesson from that is that epistemic virtues don't help us, don't provide for us a substantive theory of theory choice. Well, now, so far in talking about epistemic virtues, I've focused on the virtue-like nature of epistemic virtues. But the epistemic is equally important to pessimism about substantive theories of theory choice. Epistemic virtues should be knowledge conducive, and knowledge must be true, or at least true as we can get. So how can we defend that these virtues are truth conducive? Smolin defends the one he stresses, the production of physical insight and of new successful predictions. He defends those choices by an appeal to the history of science. Good theories have always done this before. Well, pessimistic philosophers will cite in response the simple argument with the complicated name, the pessimistic meta-induction. We now take most of our great theories of the past to be fundamentally mistaken. But we counted them as great just because they did so well in all the usual epistemic virtues. So epistemic virtue has shown itself not to be a good guide to truth. We are, then, without a reliable, well-grounded, substantive theory of theory choice. We have no account of what virtues a theory should have to justify accepting it. In parallel with the case of justice and morality, procedure, then, is the best we have left. Procedures that can nurture new theories and can manage conflict. If procedure is all we have left, then Smolin's worry about the hegemony of string theory are all the more worrying, if they're true. Physics must be open, critical, and responsive if its theories are to have any claim to rational acceptability. As in my title, physics, good physics, is conflict. Okay, now before closing, okay, I would like to return briefly to epistemic virtues and to one in particular that's essential to Smolin and also to Duff, unification. It's so essential that Smolin doesn't even defend it. In his book, the unification is the name of the game. But why? It is in no better state than any of the other so-called epistemic virtues when it comes to claims to truth conduciveness. Pessimistic meta-induction, yet again. We have zillions of failed attempts at unifications, not the ones that Lee is interested in, but when I studied physics, worked on it a lot, did a lot more practical things like quantum optics to see how lasers work. We have thousands of failed attempts at unifications and hosts of previously successful unifications we have now discarded. So pessimistic meta-induction shows that in the past, unification hasn't been truth-conducive, no reason to think it is particularly in the future. And a handful of unifications that we still accept do not much counter the weight for making the inductive argument. Okay, of course, if you like unity, I myself don't. My aesthetic ideal is that of Gerard Manley Hopkins. Glory be to God for dappled things. If you like unity, unification would be nice to have, if it's there to be had. Well, if there's a pot of gold in my garden, given my expensive tastes, it would be a good idea for me to start a digging campaign. But I am without very strong evidence that the gold is there. I have just a wish and a prayer. As well as an ungrounded belief that the world is nice, in just the way I think of nice being. Okay? And that's based on a few pieces of good luck that have gone my way. So in light of that, probably I had better not give up my day job at LSE to put more efforts into digging. But this is just what the theoretical physics seems to me to be doing in this hunt for a unified fundamental theory. Now, I am a great beneficiary of many advances in physics, like laser surgery and magnetic resonance, advances that are made at the sharp end, where physics is really messy, far from the nice mathematical 10 or 11 dimensional spaces where the unification projects live. Now, and as a beneficiary of this physics at the sharp end, I'm not happy entirely about the costs of digging for the grail of unity. As my daughters urge me, I would like to urge physics, please don't give up your day job.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I must say, so far, the timing of the speakers is absolutely immaculate. Very nice to be a chairperson when this sort of thing happens. Now, at this stage, we're supposed to be going to questions from the floor, but I thought that first, perhaps, in light of some of the comments that Mike made, it would be reasonable to ask the utterly unreasonable Lee Smoling to respond briefly to the refreshingly reasonable Mike Duff.
Thank you, and thank you, Michael and Nancy. I am the reasonable Lee Smoling, and my book is a product of that person. The unreasonable Lee Smolin is a construction rather like Wikipedia by many people, journalists, some unfortunate publicists, but not in the UK, thank God. And I think also perhaps some people who would prefer to reduce the argument of this book, because this book is structured on an argument, to caricature so it could be easily dismissed. It's strange to have a book misread, but let me give an example. I've already mentioned this to Michael. What about me? I think of myself as a would-be seer who fortunately was good enough at my craft to contribute occasionally to problem solving. That's very different than what Michael quoted. Page 311. And the cover copy that Michael quoted at the beginning was inconsistent with the judgment of the book and was removed in the UK edition, and therefore you will not find it in the UK edition. I was not completely happy with either the journalism or the writings of publicists. But when one writes a serious book, and this is a serious book, it's not a popularization, it's an engagement in a crisis, one expects to be read seriously and responded to seriously. I think, for example, I don't want to take very much time, but if one reads, for example, my summary, to summarize, on the basis, this is page 191, of current results, we cannot confidently assert that string theory solves the problem of quantum gravity. The evidence is mixed. To a certain approximation, it does seem to consistently unify quantum theory and gravity and give sensible and finite answers. But it is hard to decide if this is true of the whole theory. Okay. What we can say, skipping after some more of such, is that within these limitations, there is some good evidence that string theory points to the existence of a consistent unification of gravity and quantum theory. But is string theory itself that consistent unification? In the absence of a solution to problems which were mentioned in the paragraph I skipped, it seems unlikely. It seems to me this is balanced, measured, and the result of a careful argument which weighs the positives and the negatives and the pros and the cons. And that's the book that I wrote, and that's the book that has not always been reviewed, but that I think serious people should read and respond to. And as I said, part of the intention of the book is to examine the role that disagreement and argument play in the processes of science. So I welcome strongly argument and disagreement, but to the actual case made in the book. Now, I would like also to respond to Professor Cartwright's remarks about unification, which I would hope to try to explain why, in spite of the good things she said, I remain committed to the search for unification. But that, unfortunately, I don't have time for. But I take those comments seriously. The landscape problem, there are some things that Mike Duff and I agree about. The landscape problem is a serious problem, and it was the subject of my first book going back now to 1997. We're not here to debate that, but I'm glad people have caught up with the view that the landscape problem is a serious problem. What you hear behind these, what's really going on? What's really going on, I think, on reflection, which is discussed in this book, but I think even more so seeing the response and the discussion that's been carried out, is that there really are different styles of approaching difficult scientific questions. And Mike Duff objects to my distinction between seers and craftspeople. I made it differently here between hill climbers and valley crossers, but it's not disrespectful. And as I said, I see myself as a hill climber and a craftsperson, but I know who the seers are who are living now, and I pay attention to them. Okay. But I certainly don't claim to be one, and I certainly don't disrespect the craft that most of us work on. But nonetheless, there are different traditions, and I think what's going on is that there is a tradition of search for answers to foundational questions, which was dominant in the early part of the century, of which Einstein and Bohr and Schrodinger and Heisenberg and others were exponents of, which was closely informed by the philosophical tradition. These people knew where they stood in the tradition of European philosophy and saw what they were doing with respect to it. And there is then a more pragmatic tradition which took over when that tradition failed, because that tradition did fail in the 1930s because they got bogged down in so far unresolved disputes about the meaning of quantum mechanics, when there was real science to be done by pushing quantum physics forward, and a more pragmatic tradition took over, epitomized by people like Fermi, Feynman, and so forth, and pushed science forward, and the standard model of particle physics and all of the great progress in cosmology is the result of their work. And if I could put my view in one sentence, both traditions are essential for the progress of science, but the apparent difficulty of resolving the key foundational questions which Einstein left us over, now a full century after their initiation or their discovery, tells me that we need more of the kind of foundational, philosophical, reflective thinking and searching that earlier tradition represented.
Thank you very much, Lee. Okay, so we'll throw the discussion in open to everybody. It doesn't stop the speakers having a go at each other if they want, but you can join in now. We have some roving mics, is that right? Yeah. Now, okay, put your hands up clearly.
May I just respond?
Yes, all right, but very quickly. 1 minute.
Your book, Lee, has so many different versions and editions. It's a bit like the many universe interpretation of quantum mechanics. Because each time I criticize something you wrote, you'll tell me there's some version or some edition where you didn't write it. For example, I think of myself, the words, I think of myself as a seer, are here on page 287 of the version
of the proofs on which, if they did their job here, there came a warning not to quote without checking the final copy. These were the original American proofs, and that was a mistake of the copy editor that was corrected and is not in the reading. The phrase as I read it is the phrase as I wrote it and has appeared in all the published editions. Okay. And every time I review a book, I take heed of the warning to check the final copy with the publisher before I quote directly.
The other point I would, just one final point I would make, is that the fact that some of the insults have been taken out of the British edition will be cold comfort to the international string community.
See what fun it is to be a theoretical physicist. Okay, let's have some questions from the floor. Okay, down here first, please. So I should be pointing, that's all I can do.
Thank you. I'm very struck by the fact that the starting point for both Michael and Lee in their overall view of what constitutes good practice in physics is a Popperian view of the progress of science, of trying to falsify a theory against experiment. Lee's underlying argument is, essentially, you could say, string theory has failed to make testable experimental predictions at this stage, and Michael's argument seems to be that it's very young, it's early days, it took years, if you look at, like you gave the example of EPR, and then the Alan Aspect experiments only taking place 40 years after, 50 years after that. My question, therefore, is for Nancy. This Popperian view of how physics should be done from the perspective of a philosopher of science is 50, 60 years out of date. And I would just like Nancy to comment upon that and how that impacts upon this debate.
Oh, I think it impacts, thank you very much, in the way I was trying to describe. Falsifiability is in the traditional list of epistemic virtues. Different people put different things in and take them out. I really do want to, currently well-argued view is that none of the epistemic virtues are epistemic or can be defended as epistemic. And it's not so much that Popperianism is 50 years out of date, and then there was Lakatos, and then there was Kuhn, and then there's Bayesianism and so forth. It's that we have this serious problem of not being able to come up with a grounded theory of theory choice. And Popperianism is just one, in a sense, failure, a thoughtful, careful failure.
There's one question at the back first, right at the very back. That's right, yes, you. Could you run up to the... Right at the back.
My question is to Lee, really. It's about a point he raised regarding young students or young PhD researchers to be who might be embarking on their studies into physics. And one of the points he mentioned is that lots of young students are possibly seduced by the glamour attached to string theory and are being shifted or directed towards string theory, as you put it. I mean, sorry for paraphrasing you, but that's the general impression I get. Now, at another level, you also claim that most physicists are craftspeople or hill climbers, as you put it, and there's a very small number of seers or valley divers or whatever you call them. And so my question is really, does it really matter if a large number of students are perhaps going towards string theory, which you view as like a bad thing, if a few seers, in your view, happen to go down the right route and then 20 years down the line attract in a large number of craftspeople towards the view that may be right? This is according to your view. Whereas from string theory point of view, it hardly matters if a lot of people go towards... I mean, how is it a bad thing if a large number of young physicists go towards a particular theory if 20, 30 years down the line, the right theory will win in the end?
It's not a bad thing, and of course, people should, including students, should work on those things they think are more promising. The most important thing we do as scientists is invest our time towards directions where we think are most promising and where we can have an effect. The only thing I believe is that the evaluation of young people should be done on the basis of their individual merit and principle, and I include in that their intellectual independence, their leadership, their ability to invent and follow their own research programs without regard to whether they follow a research program which is larger or pre-existing or not. And I think that it's not difficult. It's a question. I mean, I agree with Nancy about the difficulty of theory choice, but nonetheless, these are issues that are easily recognized and dealt with and implemented.
Nick, could you...
Injury to insult, but I think that what's the trouble with physics is that it's deeply neurotic. if this is seriously misrepresented, the basic intellectual aim, there is this official view that the basic aim is truth, and the basic method is to assess contributions to knowledge impartially with respect to the evidence. And this is the problem with string theory is open to that method of assessment and the other. But this view is really nonsensical. Physics, the theories that are put forward are always unified theories, or more or less unified theories. And one could always concoct endlessly many horribly disunified theories with fake evidence much better, which never get considered precisely because they lack the all important requirement of being unified. And what that means, it seems to me, is that there is this big implicit assumption that is being made in the method that the universe is more or less unified. It's such that no seriously disunified theory is true, worth considering. If one was more honest about the basic aims of business and acknowledged this big, highly problematic, metaphysical, untestable assumption, one would have a sort of basis, one could develop a basis for objectively assessing ideas for new theories before they reach the possibility of them being tested experimentally.
So you're saying the trouble with physics is done by physicists, really, isn't it?
I mean,
the trouble with physics is that it's swallowed a bad philosophy. It's exactly the philosophy of physics, incidentally, that Nancy Cartwright has taken for granted. It's time that physicists adopted a somewhat more Einsteinian view. I mean, one of the things about Einstein was, you know, his famous remark, you know, the incomprehensible thing about the universe is comprehensible. And I think that was actually quite basic for Einstein. He even said towards the end of his life that he couldn't really believe in
Thank you. Nancy, do you want to say something?
I always welcome people, comments that point out that unity is really a very important aim in physics, and it is more, what actually happens is more directed towards unification than towards getting it right for just the reasons that were just stated. And I find that problematic, and the questioner has the opposite, but it seems to me that it's an important point about the structure of how physics is done.
Well, I'd just say thank God Maxwell didn't question the need to unify when he unified electricity.
He's Maxwell. His name is Maxwell.
The other one. Thank God the Maxwell from the other century didn't question the need to unify electricity and magnetism when he did. Thank goodness that Weinberg, Salam, and Glashow didn't stop to question whether they should unify the weakened electromagnetic interactions. So I'm going to stick with the winning team.
You just forgot all the losers who were on that team.
That's another question, please. From
there's a question.
Can you speak close to the mic because they're very short range?
Can you? Is that better?
It's about the same, actually.
Is that better?
Oh, yes, much better. Yes.
There's a question implicit in the first clause of the title, "The Trouble with Physics," and I would like very briefly to throw a spanner in the works and suggest to you what the trouble with physics is. When people first started to knock bits out of atoms, I think about 1870, and for about the next three decades, the assumption was that space and time are the same in an atom as outside an atom. Also, that everything inside an atom was like everything outside an atom, but smaller. That is, space was space, time is time, particles are particles, and waves are waves. By the 1920s and 30s, it had become very obvious that space and time very different inside atoms and outside atoms, but that fact, or those facts, have never been incorporated into quantum theory. And I think if they were, all the problems would disappear and relativity and quantum theory would unite into one theory. I could tell you a lot more about the space and time. I'm not prepared to monopolise Professor Smollett's time because he is trying to sell a book. But I would not be pleased to talk to him.
This is serious. I'm trying to have a discussion in the context of the tradition, if you like, of natural philosophy, of serious writing about issues and problems that science faces. And time again, when science has been at a turning point, scientists have written in a way that the public could read, if you like, look over our shoulders as we argue with each other. But I'm engaged. This is not publicity. This is not popularization. I'm engaged, and we all in our field are engaged in a discussion and an argument because we don't know. We're puzzled. We're deeply puzzled by the turn that our science has taken. And this book is one of half a dozen books to come out in the last several years which engage this issue. Others, for example, are by Lisa Randall, Lenny Susskind, Lawrence Krauss, Peter White. There are still others coming by other people, Alex Vilenkin. There is a beautiful opportunity for the public to look over our shoulders as we debate the most puzzling issues in our science, and that's what this is. It's a move in an ongoing debate.
There's a good man. Enough of that one. Okay. Question here, please. You need a mic.
Question mainly directed at Michael's comments about the length of time that various developments have taken to emerge. And I think you mentioned entanglement taking a long time. When I was doing my PhD in particle physics, I vaguely remember there's probably one or perhaps two people working on entanglement, which might kind of explain why it took rather a long time for much progress to be made. My mate Mike Green used to tell me about this strange thing he was working on called string theory, and I used to think, well, he's a bit mad working on that, but there's just him doing it and a couple of his mates. I'm now a professor at a business school, and I have to look at investment proposals. I gather that there's rather a lot of people working on string theory today, and I was intrigued by the comments that Michael made that, well, maybe we won't make progress this year or this decade or beyond. I just wondered, if you were pitching to a politician, how many people and how many years would you suggest the government funds this research before they pull the plug on it?
Well, the short answer would be for as long as smart physicists are working on it. But you raise a very good point. There are many more people working on string theory than there were on these other subjects that you mentioned. But so is the difficulty of the problem that they're setting themselves. They're not trying to explain just one tiny corner of physics. They have a much more ambitious goal of an all-embracing theory that will explain all physical phenomena. And that's not going to happen overnight. Theories of everything don't fall off trees. And you're right that there are many more people working on it, but I would say that the challenge is also commensurable with it.
I have found talking with people in investment, especially high-tech investment, very, very instructive. One venture capitalist I spoke with, I asked him, how do you judge the degree of risk to take on? And he said, if more than 10% of the companies we fund are still in business after 5 years, we're not taking enough risk and we won't be making as much money as we could be if we took on more risk. And I'm perfectly happy to say that a number of the research programs that I've contributed to, the way that I envisioned they would work out, are by now dead, and the young people who carry them on are doing something which has different names and is envisioned differently than what my friends and I envisioned 20, 25 years ago. And what I'm doing now is different. And I don't mind calling those earlier things failures, probably even over-exaggerating, because I think, you know, I wish that we, when we report to the funding councils, there was a place in the application for new funding, for renewed funding, to say, explain how your previous ideas failed and what your new departures are. Another person, this venture capitalist, another thing this venture capitalist told me is that they don't mind if they fund somebody and their company fails. If it's the right person or the right mix of people, they'll fund them again for a different idea. But granting that they came back honestly and said, our idea failed, whether it's biotech or software or something like that, if they honestly can be trusted to self-evaluate in a high-risk situation, then they can be trusted again after failure. And I wish that we had, not perhaps all of science, but those of us who do this high-risk payoff stuff, that we had the kind of interaction with our funders that people in high-tech business have with the venture capitalists.
I'd like to see physics doing a bit more theory of everything, not a single theory of everything, but spreading the resources to do theories of all the things that physics can profitably address. And so I do worry about the resource allocation problem.
Well, I've been thinking, would you like to endow a chair in our group at Fieber College? See me afterwards. Yes, in front, please. Yes, just there. Just there. You need to speak pretty close. That's not a lot.
Like that. Oh,
like
yeah.
A pop star does. You should swallow it.
Yeah. Going back to the analogy of the hills, the landscape with the various height of hills in it, I wonder if you could correct me. I think I may have it wrong, but I thought I understood it that in we were talking about evolution in biology, that nothing went downhill.
Gone downhill.
Someone's made a policy decision to turn you off.
It's still not working. Oh, you have to have it this way round. I see, right. Okay, I thought that nothing went downhill in evolution, that you're extinct if you tried to go downhill, that evolution only went uphill. And I wonder if that's related to... Oh, dear.
Just keep steady. If I can just address that.
Give it a shake.
Working.
It always works.
It's a waste of time trying to change scientists' mind. You just have to wait for the old guards to die out, and the history of science is so. And that's how you get a scientific revolution. You wait for the old guard to die out, rather than expecting to go downhill and up the other side.
So, I'm not an expert in theoretical biology, but I have studied it, and I have had an excursion where I tried to work in it. And one of the great problems in theoretical biology is if you have a situation where you're trying to optimize some quantity and it has many hills, what you would call many local maxima, but only one optimum, okay, how do you find the optimum and how do you not get trapped in the small hills? Okay. And to do that, you have to go down, and there's a large literature by people like Stuart Kaufman, but he's only one of a whole community of people, exactly trying to understand how in natural selection one can go down a little bit before going up again. And I'm not an expert on it, and I don't know if all of it is finished science, but you can find lively discussions of speciation and so forth exactly in the terms of going down before you go up.
Okay, thank you. Another question at the back, yes. Oh, hi. My PhD student. He's not a string theorist.
Hello. I would like to address Michael Delf. In my opinion, he failed to address the most important point of Lee's book, which is that regardless of the quality of their ideas, if a young scientist decides not to study string theory, they damage their career, plain and simple. I'd like to know what you think about that and how you think, whether you think that's a good thing, whether you think that can be changed.
I think it isn't true. In fact, most... I think the simple fact is that it isn't true. With the switching on of the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, most of the jobs in the last year or so, or going back a couple of years, are going actually to particle physicists, particle physics phenomenologists, perhaps rightly so, given that the machine's about to be switched on. They're not going to string theorists particularly.
If I may, because here we agree. What I precisely said was nothing like that and wrote. What I precisely wrote was comparing people who work on different approaches to the problem of quantum gravity. And in that context, the statement that Mike criticized me for of the only three positions, it was only three junior faculty positions going to people working on approaches to quantum gravity which are not string theory in the United States since 1991, and that's a correct fact. But one has to be careful of exaggeration, is clear, and I would ask you really to try to quote me correctly. Michael is absolutely right. And the journalist that he quoted, I haven't read that piece, but if he quoted the journalist correctly, which I assume he did, that journalist has gotten a wildly exaggerated claim from something that I formulated very precisely and very carefully. And it's very frustrating to try to write something which is carefully worded and to have it over and over again being misquoted by journalists. I should say the majority of journalists and reviewers have not misquoted the book, but a number have, and it's very frustrating when one is on very contested ground where my colleagues and I, we have, as you see, very strong views and feelings.
Your question, Luke, is just...
I should perhaps declare my bias because I'm also a string theorist at Imperial. but the point I would like to make is this. If you wish to stimulate this kind of scientific debate, you say that it is frustrating that the journalists take it on board and they misquote you and so forth. But there are structures in place in which you can have this debate. Okay, we have our archive. We have peer-reviewed journals. 3 weeks ago, I was in Athens, and I was speaking to somebody who knows no English whatsoever, no theoretical physics whatsoever, but she knows that I'm a string theorist. And she said to me, is there not this man, his name is Smolin, he's just written a book that's disproved your theory, okay? Sure, you were misrepresented, but if you choose to write a book such as this, you bear the responsibility for the consequences of it.
So if I may, because I think that is that is directed at me, every substantial part, every part of the critique of string theory, as well as all the other science here, was presented in detail in First on the Archive. And I'm happy to give you the archive numbers later, but they're all referenced there. And some people did respond, and where I work, Perimeter Institute, where there are very good people across the board in these different approaches, including string theory, we have lively, friendly discussions. I think that the discussion has been going on inside the community. If I may, however, I don't think that enough of it goes on. So, for example, when we have conferences in non-string quantum gravity, which we do more or less annually, we make sure of two things. We make sure the different active approaches are all represented, including string theory. We always invite two string theorists, at least, for a week program. And we make sure that there's always a critic, somebody who comes and whose role is to stand up and tell us what we're all doing wrong. Okay. These things are not the practice in the major string theory conferences.
I agree.
Okay. And as somebody who has worked both in string theory and not in string theory, it has been extremely frustrating to be typed. That is, because I've written some papers on something which is not string theory, when I go to, it doesn't always happen, but when I go, as I've done a number of times, to the annual string theory conferences, people will approach me and say, why are you here? I could multiply that endlessly, but I think that, so first of all, I agree with your first point, okay? And I was scrupulous that every issue, scientific issue in the book, was several years to a full year before the finishing of the book in the scientific literature and so that I can take into account of the responses. In fact, quite deliberately, if you look at a few papers, they were designed to do that. And as far as the question of responsibility is concerned, there's a long discussion of our relationship to our friends in journalism and so forth. My sense, and I want to make myself clear, most of the people who practice scientific journalism do it very well and are very scrupulous, are very aware of what's going on. The reviews which have misquoted the book, which have been a minority of them, have not been people whose specialty was scientific journalism. I have nothing but the highest respect. Most people in scientific journalism do a very difficult job, carefully and scrupulously and well. One can speculate about why, you know, these books have gotten, because this is one of a number of books on this, have gotten attention, and that's an interesting conversation. But it's, with respect, it's not the conversation that I would prefer to have. The conversation I would prefer to have is about the science and both where to go as scientists, what to do, what do we believe, why, formulate arguments, argue with each other. Okay. That's the discussion that I prefer to have, and that's the substantial part of the discussion of the book. The secondary, the framework that that's put in, is a discussion about the nature of science and how science works, and that's also an intellectual discussion which has nothing to do with publicity. It's an attempt, very humble attempt, to make a contribution to the work of people like Nancy Cartwright, that is, why it is that science works and how.
We almost ran out of time, but somebody was waving at me somewhere from there. Yeah. Just one quick question, please, because we have a...
I think there's a...
That's John Taylor.
I think there's a question here that I'd like to ask both Lee and Mike as to the nature of the epistemic virtues that they consider. From what I've heard and what I did when I worked in the SuperString theory many years ago, I got the impression that the SuperString theory had a richness to it that came from the tradition of Albert Einstein through curved space times in the SuperString theory and so on. It was a richness that doesn't maybe, at least to my view, yet come in what Lee is talking about, loose spaces and the related questions. And I wonder if there was a very brief word from each of them as to what they see as the true reasons that they got young people flooding in sickness rooms and not at the genocide.
Thank you, John. Wait, Lee, go ahead, Mike.
Do you want to go first?
No, you go first.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, as Chris just said to me sotto voce, unless you were going to say it, that was a malprophism. Anyway, those of us who work on mostly things other than string theory, foundational approaches to quantum mechanics and quantum gravity, get plenty of student interest as well. And so we don't want to give the impression that somehow the student interest is going only one way. We turn away most of the student interest, as I'm sure our friends in string theory do. The richness of string theory, the idea of string theory, the basic idea of unification through extended objects, dual, if I can speak a technical word once, dual to gauge theories, has tremendous motivation and I think is true. My judgment is probably true. That's the core idea. For me, the disjunction between the approaches that I'm willing to bet my time on and those that I'm not has to do with the issue of background independence that I mentioned. As a consequence of that, the attempt to work out that idea of duality of gauge theories and string theories in a background-dependent context leads us to the necessity of 9 or 10 spatial dimensions and supersymmetry. Okay. Now, that is either correct about nature or incorrect. That's the big bet. Okay. And it leads to tremendous richness because there are so many possibilities for treating the geometry and the topology of the extra dimensions.
And that is either a deep insight into nature or it's a wrong turn. And indeed, that issue of what to do about unification through higher dimensions and the geometry and the stability of the extra dimensions has been in play since 1920, 22, 23. And I don't have time to quote it to find it, but I found some very interesting letters by Einstein discussing these issues already in the early 1920s. If you develop that same idea, which I think is the deep idea behind string theory, in a background independent context, without the picture of strings moving in a classical geometry, but taking the whole geometry quantum mechanically as the degrees of freedom that arise out of the dynamics of these extended objects, and to the people who are not technical, I excuse me for the slightly technical word, you get loop quantum gravity and spin foam models precisely on the nose. That's what they are. So one possibility is that these are different, and this is what I advocated in my second book, that string theory and loop quantum gravity are merely different manifestations, different ways with different mathematical techniques to explore a fundamental and possibly deep and fundamental idea, which is the role of one-dimensional objects, strings, in the unification of physics.
Thank you. Mike?
As Chris mentioned at the beginning, in the early 70s, I was one of... Chris and I were contemporaries, believe it or not. And
the old guard.
The great question then was, how do you unify gravity and quantum mechanics? They seem to be completely irreconcilable. And string theory came along, and in our opinion, in the opinion of string theorists, has solved that problem. And that cannot be underestimated, that it's incorporated the best of quantum theory and of Einstein's general relativity into one unified whole. And in contrast to most of the alternative theories, it not only does that, but it provides a way, we think, of explaining the structure of the elementary particles. And it's this cohesion that I think impresses the young minds and persuades them that their future lies in string theory.
Well, thank you. I'm afraid we have to stop at this point. I mean, one thing you may be thinking is how incredibly lucky we are to be theoretical physicists. It's an enormous privilege, actually, to be allowed to earn a modest income doing this for our careers. Anyway, I hope you've all enjoyed this evening's discussion. It's certainly been lively. And I'd like to thank all of our three speakers very much indeed for their contributions.
There's such a sort of intellectual energy in the room, and I'm going to invite you all to go for a drink in a second, so I thought, how can I sort of, you know, lower the tone a bit? I thought a pathetic joke would come in handy, so I was thinking of asking the question, can you tell me what a string is? Because, of course, the answer to that would be, afraid not. Sorry. Now, you can continue the discussion over a drink in the RSA lecture bar, which tonight is in the RSA vaults. It says here, which is rather frightening, please take the door to my right and follow the stairs down as far as you can go, which after this discussion is a terrifying thought. I think it's only about four floors. Tonight, just to say quickly, tonight's event forms part of the world's largest free lecture program. This program is made possible by the support of our network of RSA fellows. So those of you who are here in London who are not yet fellows, you can make a donation as you go out, or possibly more importantly, you could think about joining the RSA fellowship. You can pick up a pack, you can email us, or you can speak to any member of staff here this evening. But then, finally, once again on your behalf, I'd like to offer my formal thanks to the panel. It's been an absolutely fantastic discussion, and to ask you to join me in thanking them and our chair this evening, Professor Chris Isham.